Welcome back to the Greg Hughes Podcast. Now, our guest today is a man who played a silent but vital role in one of humanity's greatest achievements. In 1969, as the world held its breath watching the Apollo 11 lunar module descend towards the moon's surface, the lives of Armstrong, Aldrin and Collins depended on the integrity of a heat shield designed to withstand temperatures reaching thousands of degrees. That shield held firm thanks in large part to the work of a young scientist from Inver in County Donegal. Dr. Peter Coyle turns 89 this year, 2026, and while he remains incredibly unassuming about his contributions, his journey is anything but ordinary. It's a path that took him from the hills of South Donegal to the University of Minnesota and eventually into the high-stakes laboratories of Dow Chemical, where his expertise in epoxy resins and solar innovation helped fuel the American space race. Despite his brilliance, Dr. Coyle has often described himself as a small cog in a big wheel. However, the magnitude of his impact was never lost on NASA or the US government, who famously sent the American defense attaché to Donegal to honor his family for his work. Today, we're going to step back in time to the 1960s to discuss the primitive technology of the era, the intense pressure of the moonshot, and how he views the new frontier of space exploration in 2026. Dr. Peter Coyle, thank you so very much for talking to us on the Greg Hughes Podcast today. We had a brief conversation on the radio show, but your story is so interesting. I'm delighted that you accepted our invite for a longer format conversation. So thank you very much in the first instance.
That's okay.
I suppose what fascinates me is how a young man from Inver could end up making his way to the University of Minnesota and eventually into the, you know, the inner circles of the American space race. Is it easy for you to talk us through that journey?
Well, it's my grandfather, who was a local hotelier here in Inver, Drumbeg Hotel. He was German. He was quite famous, a very good hotelier as well. He decided to send me to Newbridge Dominican College there in 1950 to 55. So I went there and became almost a Dominican. I wanted to be a priest. And then the Father Kiley, who was the headmaster, said in his Cork accent, he said, no, he said, I think you should go to UCD. You're good at science and mathematics and stuff like that. So off I went to UCD and got my bachelor of science degree between 55, October 55, and through 59. And I got a first-class honors degree in physical and organic chemistry. And I got a BSc in mathematics, biochemistry, and chemistry. And because of that, I got a scholarship, joint Irish American scholarship, to go to any university I like. And I chose Leeds because there was a man there called Professor Dainton, Fred Dainton. He subsequently became Lord Dainton of Hallamore. He was from Sheffield. And he was a graduate of Oxford, professor of chemistry there, and he worked in Cambridge as well. And he was a polymath, absolute brilliant, motivating, great man. I admire him greatly, even though he's long dead now. I graduated anyway in November 59, and Fred asked me over to Leeds, so I flew into Yeadon Airport in November. And if you want to have a scary ride on an airplane from Dublin in November to Yeadon Airport in Yorkshire, be my guest. So I landed there and went in to see Fred at the chemistry department at Leeds University, and he looked at me through these thick lens glasses, slightly baldish man, upper English accent, and he said, where are you from? And I said, Donegal, and a broad Donegal accent. I can't do the Donegal accent anymore, unfortunately. And we spoke about various subjects for a while. After about 5 minutes, he said, could you stop a minute, old boy? I said, yes, sir. And he said, what language are you speaking? And I said, English. That was my introduction to France. Anyway, he accepted me. Well, and after three...
Just before we move on there, just when you were studying in Ireland, what was it with a view to doing, if you know what I mean? Obviously, you were excelling in your chosen studies, but had you at that point laid out some sort of a career path or where you thought you might end up?
No, absolutely not. I was just, I didn't drink. I didn't go to dances. I just studied and didn't study that much. And I just enjoyed my friends. We had no plans for the future whatsoever, except to get a degree and to survive. And I had a problem because at the end of the first quartile, that was October to December, 55, I ran out of money because my grandfather had... died, I think it was, and I didn't know what to do, and I had a pal called Bill Hickey, and they invited me to their house in Clontarf and for dinner, and while I was talking to him and his family, I noticed his father wasn't there, and I said, where's your father? He said, he died in the war, the Royal Air Force. And I said, oh, mine did too, in 1939. And he said, you know, I know you're short of money. Why don't you go to the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund on Marion Square there, and they help children of, you know, the Royal Air Force people that get killed. So I called the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, went down there, met a hoi polloi squadron leader, somebody or other, whose name escapes me, very polite. And I gave him the details. He said, oh, boy, come back next week and we'll have a chat. And so I came back the following week and they got the details and they granted me £3 a week. And that would be good for as long as I wanted to get the BSc. But if I failed, I was out. That was the message. So anyway, I didn't fail. And I got my BSc, general degree, and I got good enough, sufficient, I'd say, superior results than that, that I was allowed into the special course in 1959. The special course was where they split chemistry into organic chemistry, and then the other side was physical and organic chemistry. And that was the first time that was done at UCB. And I said, okay, I want to do physical and organic chemistry. Did that, got a first, and then I got the scholarship, which was Joint Irish American Government Scholarship. And that projected me into Leeds.
Yes, and
that's how it worked.
And pick it up then from Leeds. I think you were going to say you were 3 years in Leeds, were you? How did you find yourself in the United States then?
No, I was 3 years in Leeds, 1963. That's about the duration of a PhD study. And we were at the high energy radiation laboratory at Cookridge Hospital, at Cookridge. And it was an associate of Leeds University. And they had a, what's called a cobalt 60 unit. That's a very intense gamma radiation source, 2000 curie source. And they had X-ray machines and all that. But gamma radiation, as you probably know, is the most intense radiation in the whole universe. So we were studying the effects of that gamma radiation. My study was on pure water because the human cell is over 90% water, basically. And we wanted to know what happened in the human cell when you radiated fairly intense radiation, like X-rays or gamma radiation or stuff like that, or even ultraviolet radiation for that matter. So that took 3 years, wrote a thesis, and I was granted a doctorate by the university. And a friend of mine there was Dr. Graham Bingham, brilliant guy. At the age of 20, he had a PhD and in astrophysics. And he wanted to go to Minneapolis because Minneapolis had a very good astrophysics laboratory, you know, department in the physics department. And we were pals, and so we decided we'd just go to Minneapolis. And I decided I wanted to get away from radiation chemistry to photochemistry. Photochemistry is non-ionizing radiation because you use light. And light is not so intense in terms of damage to cells or anything else. And it does not pack the energy that gamma radiation has. So I wanted to see what would happen. And we ended up over there in Minneapolis. That's how that happened. It was sort of ad hoc. We'll do this, we'll do that, blah, blah, blah.
It's amazing. But very shortly thereafter, if my timeline corrects, you did get involved in the big program. A lot of pressure with coming from JFK, perhaps you could argue self-imposed. Was the commitment, the promise, the whole moonshot decade, was that on your radar in Leeds? Or at what point did it come on your radar in the United States? Or did you have any interest in space or what was happening in the race, I suppose, to the moon?
Well, we did have an interest in the sense that it wasn't an interest of getting involved and doing work or research work. It was just a normal person interested in, you know, space and stuff like that. But Graham, being my pal, I went over to see him in his lab one day over there. It was right opposite my lab across the campus. And he was doing shaker tests on the command capsule, on a model of the command, the stainless steel unit where the astronauts would lie going out to space and coming back. And he was shaking it to bits. His job was to see what's the breaking point on the stainless steel structure.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of intrigued me a bit, you know. But I didn't pursue it any further. I continued doing this basic research on photochemistry at very low temperatures because the American Army wanted to charge some sort of an electric battery in outer space where it's very, very cold and see if you could release radiation from that.
Just before we move on, that sounds very much like solar innovation before we were sort of even talking about that. Is that the space we're in?
Well, I went, you know, Kennedy talked about it on May 25th, 1961. So the American interests there were political and military, of course. And the political ones was the Soviets were outmaneuvering the Americans in terms of space, you know, Sputnik and all that. And the Americans just wanted to tell everybody that they were superior in technology and they weren't going to allow this communist country, USSR, to, you know, make them look stupid. And they put the first man in space, of course. And it was all the American political and military complex and the competition with the USSR that catalyzed this thing. So I was just doing my basic research in Leeds at that time, 61. I didn't get to America in 63.
Uh-huh.
But my involvement really got involved. I joined the Dow Chemical Company. I decided to get into a chemical company for one simple reason. You made more money than being at the university. And so they were delighted to have me. Anybody with a PhD in those days, my God, they were all looking for you everywhere, you know, to take you on. And so I joined them in December 64, I think it was. Yeah. Signed the books. They gave me a week's salary, and I took a plane ticket back to Dublin for Christmas. Then I came back in January, and that was how I started. And then I worked in various functions in Dow, production, tech service, sales, marketing, research, communications. And they were next in chemical company, a very big chemical company. And after about 3 years with them, four years with them, I became ran the epoxy resin business. This is how I got involved in the space program, because we made the product type that they wanted.
But But what was the planned function for Epoxy Novolac? It wasn't developed specifically, was it, for the space program? What was it? What was it designed or being developed for its actual, I suppose, Earth use? If I could put it like that.
Well, epoxy resins are used as glues, you know, and they're made from two chemicals, epichlorohydrin, which Dow made, and bisphenol A, which Dow made. But Novolac was made using what's called Parabis. I recommend that anybody listening to this just looks up their Google what is Parabis. But it's a chemical structure slightly different from bisphenol A. And the aspect of the Novolac was it highly, very strong coating, and it was used for very abrasive materials like storing acids and stuff like that.
Right.
You see?
Yeah.
And very resistant to corrosion, and you could blend it with anything, and it had a tremendous adhesive power. So and all of those things.
Who made, not I suppose an individual, at what stage was the connection made that this could aid the re-entry? Because I presume, you know, the problems that needed to be resolved or fixed or solved, it was on the fly to some extent. So how would we have made the connection between, you know, the intense effects on the spacecraft, for an example, and Epoxy Novolac? Who made that connection, I wonder?
Well, there's a whole, you know, there was 400,000 people working on this program. And I mean the whole program, these 400,000 people were in 4,000 different companies.
Okay.
And we were in one company, Dow, and we had a customer called Hysol in Los Angeles, and Hysol was a specialist in epoxy coatings, epoxy adhesives, and anything you do with epoxies. And, of course, we were the biggest manufacturer in the States and the most sophisticated one in this area. And then Hysol was, I think they were, finally, the lunar module itself, the stainless steel module, was made in Los Angeles. And Rockwell was the main contractor, and they subcontracted everything to everybody else. And so Hysol was asked by Avco in Massachusetts, who were making the shield, putting it together, probably is a better way of putting it, to come up with an adhesive to hold it onto a stainless steel lunar module and to pack in this granules in the hexagonal honeycomb structure, fiberglass structure. See, what happened then was this fiberglass structure was manufactured, and it was like a beeswax. And what you did is you glued it onto the stainless, highly polished, very clean stainless steel lunar module where the astronauts would be in. And you had to make sure that it stayed on. And since the lunar module's surface was curved, you know,
yeah, but with all that in mind, how could you effectively simulate the extreme transition from the vacuum of space to that intense heat of the Earth's atmosphere without, you know, all of the technology we have now? How could that be achieved?
Oh, that was, well, it's quite easy. Neil Armstrong was one of the pilots of the X-15, which was a rocket-type plane which was dropped from a big B-52 or something over the U.S. desert, and then it was just, he'd hit the rockets, and the thing would go at 4,000 miles an hour, and it would be out of about the limits of space, which is about, I'd say, the edge of space, maybe it's better. And the American military defined the edge of space as 50 miles or 80 kilometers up. And so he would go up there, and the nose cone of this rocket was pointed. And this is important because in the late 50s, a guy called Allen, who was a mathematics guy, said, this is all wrong. Oh, let me go back a bit. Anyway, Neil Armstrong was up there, rocket malfunction, the X-15. So he parachuted to the ground. And you know what he did next? He just got back in his office and started doing his paperwork. That's the sort of guy he was.
And from those tests, did it require a lot of tweaking to prove to a point where you could rely on it that this epoxy novolac would perform as expected?
Oh, God, yeah. This was all fired, burned, shot up in 1966. I think the first one was shot up there, and we saw it come back, and we saw where the defects were and where the geometry wasn't right. Because the thing was curved, the heat shield was curved, and the thickest part is at the center.
Uh-huh.
You see, and that's where the most intense heat would be, 5,000 Fahrenheit, would be that right there. And then as it went off towards the edges of the thing, this thing tipped towards the edges of the lunar module, and the hot air would go off into space and get cooler at the edges and stuff like that. So the reason for all that was that you needed the least amount of weight that you could possibly get. So you're trying to shave off all these extra bits here and there and everywhere. And then you wanted to make sure that the whole thing stuck together, because you're traveling at 27,000 kilometers, you know, an hour, which is 17,000 miles an hour, I think, last time I calculated. So these were shot up the outer atmosphere, they re-entered, they burned, they were picked up in the ocean and looked at, and you know, and they were burned on the ground in facilities as well, intense heat blasting them. But Alan was the guy, the mathematician that designed this shape to be the maximum or the optimum shape, I'd say saved the whole thing, because we had to have this sort of a tapered, sharply tapered nose on the heat shield that would have broken apart and everybody would have been dead. But yeah, he said, no, you need a curved one.
Fascinating.
And he proved it mathematically. I mean, there was just geniuses involved. They were all doing it in their head. You know?
Well, you see, that's what I was going to ask you, because, you know, by today's standards, the computing power used for Apollo 11 was incredibly limited. And I'm just wondering, for you as a scientist on the project, did you feel the weight of those technical limitations, or did the physical chemistry, the mathematics, all of that feel more reliable than the digital tools you had at the time?
Oh, listen, there was a film recently which I found quite intriguing. A whole lot of mathematical ladies who were in Houston were doing the calculations. These were all black people, and they were treated abysmally. And they would do the mathematics, and they were brilliant at the mathematics. I mean, it was human. They just did it. They had a little calculator, you know, you could calculate it. But you ran into some thermodynamic equations that told you the rate of heat dissipation from the from the heat shield and things like that. I mean, you got into really complicated thermodynamics and stuff. And one person couldn't do it. You had to have a whole host of people who were specialists in certain areas. Some people were specialists in geometry, metallurgy, how much energy you can get from oxygen-hydrogen mix versus oxygen-kerosene mix. I mean, the first, the Redstone missile was fueled by an oxygen-kerosene mix, which only gave about, I think, 50,000 pounds of thrust, and we needed 1.5 million pounds of thrust. And von Braun and Konrad Dannenberg, the Germans from the B-1, B-2 rockets, decided to string six huge engines together.
Yes.
They got 1.5 million pounds of thrust out of these engines, and they could lift 130 tons, which was enough to get the thing through the escape velocity, you know, out into the space. You had to have an escape velocity to get past Earth's gravity.
You've often described yourself as a small cog in a big wheel, and we've talked of the numbers, but I wonder at what point, if a point arrived, did it actually sink in with you that your specific work was protecting the lives of Armstrong, Aldrin and Collins?
Well, there were so many people involved. I don't know how to answer that question.
Yes, but I've circumnavigated that answer by saying you've already described yourself as a small cog in a big wheel.
Well, cog was a very small cog. I'm going to be 89 in a month or two anyway, and I'm still a smaller cog now. But you just went along with the flow, you know. There's so many people involved. You have something to do, and you do it. And if you have problems, you find people that can solve the problems. And it was teamwork.
Yeah, but Dr. Cole, this must be your personality then, though. You must have been surrounded by people that saw themselves as bigger than that small cog. I mean, this is an insight into your personality, I suspect.
Oh, it probably is, yeah. I always believed in teamwork and using other people's expertise because they knew things better than I did, that particular piece of it, whatever. And my job was to make sure that all these pieces fitted together from the Dow chemical standpoint and the epoxy resin standpoint. But I had no responsibility for the, you know, the space capsule, lunar module or anything like that, or the rockets or the engines or, you know, or escape philosophies or the physics.
So,
you know where to get the answers.
Yeah, just reflecting on that mission as a whole, like everything was computed, everything was tested. It was all science. It was all effort. It was astonishing to bring so many people together in the way that was done. But it still remains or feels truly remarkable, even so many years, almost a lifetime removed from it. How much of it was just everybody getting absolutely everything right, and how much of it was just a remarkable tailwind that sort of meant that all of the computing came to pass?
Well, let me give you an example there. I'm sorry about that. They were testing the command module for a different Apollo mission, 7 or 8, I think it was, on the ground. And 3 astronauts were killed in the capsule, the lunar module, on the ground. And the reason they were killed was that the smart guys had decided that the internal part of there was too much oxygen in it, 16 pounds per square inch in the lunar module. And the door opened only from the inside. You couldn't open it from the outside. So here's an example of where 3 people got killed on the ground because of 2 miscalculations. So they redesigned it and put the door, you could open it from the outside so people could get at it, and they dropped the oxygen down to normal levels. And these things were experiments on the ground where we saw these mistakes being made, you see? But 3 people died on that experiment. So I don't know if that answers it in part.
No, it does. You. It does. It does. And they, in sacrificing their lives, played a crucial part in the whole story as well. I think we could conclude.
Well, you know, the thing that ignited the oxygen in the Apollo 7 or 8 was a bad wire. It wasn't wired properly.
Wow.
So, I mean, we've seen this with Boeing in the last 20 years with some of those big 747s and some of the big planes they're making, wires that weren't going the right place. I mean, it's so complex, you know, people just suddenly decide that, well, maybe it goes here. That's fatal.
Yeah.
Now, you got to know exactly where it's going.
One of the things about this whole journey for me, which was fascinating, was when the American defense attaché, Colonel Joseph F. O'Connor, traveled all the way to South Donegal to honor your mother, Florence. This was in 1969. Was it the cinema in Donegal Town?
Yes.
It's that goal. As well. I was in there and I never realized this history even existed. Well, he traveled over here to effectively thank her for your work, which I also think is a quite an interesting little thing. Did the penny drop at home, not even outside the family, but with the family, on what you were actually doing over in America? Because of course we didn't have we didn't have video calling, we didn't have the technology we're speaking on right now. I'm not saying you didn't have contact with home, but to have this American land over here and say, you know, Florence, your son's amazing, look what he's achieved, like, what was that, what was the reaction in the family or in the community or what?
Well, my family, I'm one of eight kids, and my family are all, you know, we're all get on very well, and we're accept what the other one's doing or not doing, and we never really were very inquisitive about it. And I don't remember anybody clapping me on the back and saying something like that. And my poor mother always exaggerated, you know, that I was a genius or I was this or I was that, and I was highly embarrassed. But you know, the colonel came up and gave her a big, big check. You know, they spent $24 billion by 89 on this program. And I think that's about $215 billion or something in today's dollars. And he gave her the big sum of 40 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Oh, something else.
You astonishing, know, isn't it?
100, I would say.
But I mean, I just, if something like that happened now, and I'm not sure what the media coverage was at the time, but that would be live everywhere. I mean, I, as a journalist in Donegal, this would just have been the biggest story that I could cover. I presume the national media would have been all over it, if not Sky News and every other channel. It's just like maybe I'm overstating it, but that's how it feels to me, Doctor.
Well, you know, there was no real coverage of it. Nobody stopped me on the street and congratulated me or anything like that. I think so many good Irish people have gone abroad and done well and contributed to many good things. And I think it's accepted. You know, it was like when President Kennedy came back to Ireland and forgotten when that was 62 or something. And I mean, he was a hero, one of the rich, affluent, good-looking, powerful politicians, and he was set up almost as a saint. And I think that's because he was successful, and the Kennedys were successful. And I think all the people staying at home, I mean, I remember when I was at UCD, there was 70 or 80,000 people a year leaving this country.
Yeah.
And we reached a stage where I think there was only 2.8 million people left, or 3.8 million, I can't remember. And so anybody that did anything good or achieve something, I think people here accepted it and for what it was, and they didn't go out making a big issue about it or anything. Could be totally wrong about that. It's just my feeling on the subject. And that suited me fine. I never was one for a lot of publicity or, you know.
I understand. No disrespect to wave energy or wind energy, but of course we can't rely on fossil fuels forever. And it seems really, if we are going to have clean energy, it's going to be solar. I'm just curious, looking at the solar technology we use today in 2026, how closely, if at all, does it align to with what you imagined back in the 1960s, Doctor?
Well, I never thought about solar energy in the 1960s. We were looking to petrol, and petrol was bought it where it was the cheapest, and the big oil companies dominated the scene, and they were pumping vast amounts of crude oil, and there was crude oil all over the place in the Middle East, and Texas, and Oklahoma, and Alaska, and God knows. And they were all they were saying was, this is going to last forever, you know. And nobody thought about the influence of the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and all the other stuff up there until some smart people suddenly realized that there was an ozone gap up there, you know?
Yeah.
And science began to play, and then it became a real political issue because Americans like to drive the car. When I was driving in the 60s, 25 cents a gallon, and I used to go from one gas station to the other to fill up. One was a 25 and one was 26. So that was the attitude, you know. Plenty of And there was, and then, you know, this burning of coal and putting all this sulfurous stuff in the air and carbon dioxide. Now we're, I mean, we're paying for it now with all these horrible weather. Look at the weather in the United States, hurricanes and everything. And the president of the United States is in denial about all this. I mean, it's just incredible that we've reached this stage. Science is dead. It's not been correct, and it's all hogwash, and this and that. Of course, if we want to survive, we have to listen to science, we have to study it, we have to find the best way to do it economically, and sometimes that's not easy. I was advocating in the 60s when I was getting my doctorate at Leeds University that we should, instead of building massive, big nuclear power plants with the cost billions, and we're investing in huge piles of concrete, to build small ones on the fringe of cities that were small, and they, if they did leak, they wouldn't do a lot of damage. Of course, that now is in. That's the hot stuff now, building small nuclear reactors, because they're clean and they're easy to build and they work. And you don't have to pump the electricity all over, you know, 300 or 400 miles. You can pump one in Birmingham, Manchester, that area, and maybe London, whatever. And you have a very powerful source of clean electricity. It's coming now.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's people's attitudes, you know, how to, the politics of it is just something. Scientists are not really great politicians, you know.
I'm thinking, I mean, just throwing some names out there: Kathleen, Rita Antonelli, William C. Campbell, John Kellis Ingram, Thomas Wilson. There's others that I've interviewed, in fact, William Cecil Campbell, Dr. Barr, Dr. Meehan, not far from you in Mount Charles. What is in our water? And yourself, of course, I'm putting you in amongst them. What is in our water? It seems in science and research and academically, we punch incredibly above our weight, do we? Dr. Coyle, do you see it like that?
I see it, yes. The reason is we've got a very good educational system. This is one of our success stories. Our universities are very good. Our secondary colleges are very good. Sure, our schools are very good. I mean, my love for mathematics, or maybe arithmetic, I should say, was from Mrs. Mullen at Keeluk School here in Inver. And I was 13 when I left that place, and she was delighted to teach me all the arithmetic to you, you know. And it intrigued me. And she was good at poetry and English and geography and all those things. And some of us picked it up and some of us didn't. And that's the way it is, you know, it's life. But I can put my finger in her as being a great teacher. And I think there's a whole lot of great teachers like her around.
You've been incredibly generous with your time, and I have just two short questions for you. Obviously, this year we're seeing the Artemis mission to push humans back on the moon. I'm curious: does the spirit of the current space program feel the same as the one you were a part of, or has that sort of that why that it, that that curiosity behind space exploration changed in your view?
Oh yeah. It was pure science and politics and military objectives in our days. And now it's looking for resources, control these resources. That's why they want to go to Mars. There's a whole lot of resources in these places. How do you get to Mars? The best way to do it is go to the moon and then build something on the moon that you can send rockets off, and the escape velocity from the moon is nothing like the Earth. It's like, you know, very low, and you can have build a whole. I'm convinced. And anyway, let's face it, mankind has always, you know, gone abroad, looking for new things. You know, the guys that went to America and what, St. Brendan maybe went in a kayak or something. And I mean, you know, they went on sailing ships and hurricanes and everything to see what was going on. And then they got into submarines, yeah. And then they went to space. And we're a curious bunch. We just like to know what's there, what's going on. And the industrial side wants to grab the resources, and the military side wants to control the security aspects for their particular territory, and on and on it goes.
So kind of takes the fun out of it, doesn't it?
I don't know whether I'm right or wrong. But
no, I think you're spot on. And looking back over the 60-plus years since you worked on Apollo 11, have you a piece of advice that you would give a young scientist in Donegal or wherever they might be listening to this from, who dreams of working on the next frontier of space?
Well, what they should do is identify what the frontier is and then find out who's good at it. Like which college is good. I looked at radiation chemistry. One of the best in the world was Leeds University. And I just did that by asking questions of the professors, you know? And they were all unanimous that Fred Danton was the top dog in those days. And if you want to go space physics today, I don't know where it is, but it could be MIT in the States. And China, by the way, has very good science. Whether we like it or not, they're outstanding.
Yeah.
And so I would say identify what you want to do and what you're good at, and then find out who would educate you the best.
It's funny, that's very similar advice the late, great Gay Byrne gave myself and my brother about media. Funny enough, it's kind of...
Really?
Yeah, it's just, you know, find something you're interested in and find the right people who'll be able to sort of take the best of the best out of you. And one other curiosity, and I've already lied because I said there would only be two more questions, and here's the third. Did you feel any sort of envy of the guys getting into that ship and blasting off? Were you happy to sort of be part of the brains behind the operation, or was there any envy or jealousy? And I don't mean that in any untoward way. Would you have liked to have a seat on that ship, or were you happy on Terra Firma?
No, I didn't have the courage to go on that. I mean, those people were special people, those astronauts. I mean, it's like Armstrong blowing up at, you know, 80,000. Miles up in the sky, and then coming down, and then going to his office and shuffling his papers. They're a different breed. These people, everybody was with them. Maybe the only people that might have been envious were the other astronauts, because they were all competitive and they all wanted to go. And when you picked out three, obviously some people were hurt, you know. I have to say that, that's for sure. I know that. But once they were in there, nobody was jealous or anything. It was get them there and get them back and may they live. Something like that.
It really is quite remarkable. I mean, it's obvious you're across everything, still interested in the current program and of course the history. You referenced that already. I can imagine every day is a learning day still for you, Dr. Coyle, even though it seems like you've forgotten more than I will ever know. How do you entertain yourself now?
Oh, I've got a big garden here. You can always visit me if you want to come down. And don't cross the Inver Bridge. Just come up along the river, and I'm the second house on the right.
Oh, wow.
And I have a lovely garden. My wife, who and I built this garden. We built the house in 77, and we were living in Vienna at the time, and it's on family property on the River Eighty, and we love it here, and we've always fixed the garden. So I'm a keen gardener. I dig potatoes. I set potatoes every year. This year I'm not doing it because I have some medical problems, and I'm going to be 89 in a couple of months anyway, so I think I've earned my living. I cut trees when they came down. I lost 17 big trees in December. So ones that I set in the 70s when I was in Vienna, here in Donegal. So I'm interested.
Yeah, it's remarkable. It's remarkable the influence that you've had, and you're completely nonplussed about it. Although that might not be the way to describe it. It's just a remarkable contribution that you've made, and the fact that you've made it from Donegal and you're back home in your own home county now. It's just a wonderful story, and I can't thank you enough for sparing so much of your time and going through it with us. And I hope we've scratched the surface with you, Doctor. It's just been really, really enjoyable.
Thank you very much for having me.
What a remarkable gentleman. Again, thank you so much to Dr. Peter Coyle for sparing his time to chat to us today. I really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Greg Hughes Podcast. Don't forget, new episodes every Friday morning at 11 a.m. released on the Highland Radio website, highlandradio.com, and also on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a review if you like, and tell your friends. There is loads of episodes already up there, so if you haven't listened back to them, please do. If you have any feedback, comments, suggestions for guests, don't forget you can contact the researcher and producer of this podcast, Caroline Orr. You can email her, Caroline Orr at highlandradio.com. But I'll chat to you again really soon.